After that, Brolin went with Deborah to a couple of gatherings to hear about Scientology's opposition to psychotropic drugs. Although Brolin had never talked about it, he had gone to the Celebrity Center himself in a moment of real desperation and received spiritual counseling. He quickly decided Scientology wasn't for him, but he still wondered what the religion did for celebrities like Tom Cruise and John Travolta. Each has a good head on his shoulders. They make great business decisions. They seem to have wonderful families. Is that because they were helped by Scientology? Brolin once witnessed Travolta giving a Scientology assist at a dinner party in Los Angeles. Marlon Brando arrived with a cut on his leg. He had been injured while helping a stranded motorist on the Pacific Coast Highway pull his car out of a mudslide, and he was in pain. Travolta offered to help, saying he had just reached a new level in Scientology, which gave him enhanced abilities. Brando said, "Well, John, if you have powers, then absolutely." Travolta touched Brando's leg, and they each closed their eyes. Brolin watched, thinking it was bizarre and surprisingly physical. After 10 minutes, Brando opened his eyes and said, "That really helped. I actually feel different." In 2003, Cruz continued working with Rathbun on his upper levels. While he was at Gold Base, instead of staying in the cottage he had formerly shared with Nicole Kidman, Cruz moved into the guest house of L. Ron Hubbard's residence, Bonnie View. One Sunday night, following a late-night meal in Hubbard's baronial dining room, Cruz got food poisoning. The culprit was thought to be an appetizer of fried shrimp in an egg roll. The cook was summarily sent to Happy Valley. Rathbun accompanied Cruz to Flag Base in Clearwater, where he could perform the exercises required to attain OT-7. Because Miscavige depended on Rathbun to handle so many of the church's most sensitive problems, he had been lulled into feeling a kind of immunity from the leader's violent temper. In September, he returned to Gold Base and gave a report to Miscavige about Cruz's progress. Miscavige asked where Cruz would be doing his semi-annual checkups. "At Flag," Rathbun said. "All OT-7s do their checkups at Flag." "Who's going to do it?" Rathbun named an auditor in Clearwater that he thought highly of. Miscavige turned to his wife and said, "Can you believe this, SP?" He declared that, unlike any other OT-7, Cruz would get his checkups at Gold Base. When Cruz duly arrived at Gold for his semi-annual check, he was preparing for his role as a contract killer in Collateral. Miscavige took him out to the gun range and showed him how to shoot a .45-caliber pistol. Meanwhile, Rathbun administered the star's 6-month checkup. Because of his insubordination, Rathbun had to go through a program of penitence. One of the steps was to write up a list of his offenses against the church, which Miscavige had sketched out for him. "I am writing this public announcement to inform executives and staff that I have come to my senses and I am no longer committing present-time overts and have ceased all attacks and suppressions on Scientology," Rathbun admitted in September 2003, adopting the abject tone that characterizes many Scientology confessions. Speaking in full-blown Scientologese, he wrote, "The end result is unmocked org form, overworked and enturbulated executives and staff." This meant that he had not thought out his intentions clearly, causing the church and the people who worked for it to be in disarray. He had a particular apology to make to David Miscavige. "Each and every time on major situations, COB has had to intervene to clean up wars I had exacerbated. The cumulative amount of COB's time I have cost in terms of dropping balls, creating situations internally and externally, is on the order of 8 years. Rathbun was shocked, not just by being declared an SP, but also by the changes at Gold Base in the year and a half he had been posted to Flag. All communications into and out of the base had been cut off. The leader had several of his top executives confined to the Watchdog Committee headquarters, a pair of double-wide trailers that had been married together. By the end of the year, the number who were living there under guard had grown to about 40 or 50 people. It was now called the Hole. Except for one long conference table, there was no furniture, no chairs or beds, just an expanse of outdoor carpet. So the executives had to eat standing up and sleep on the floor, which was swarming with ants. In the morning, they were marched outside for group showers with a hose, then back to the Hole. Their meals were brought to them, a slop of reheated leftovers. When temperatures in the desert location mounted to more than 100 degrees, Miscavige turned off the electricity, letting the executives roast inside the locked quarters. The leader ordered them to stay until they finally had rearranged the org board, the church's organizational chart, to his satisfaction, which was never given. Photographs of Sea Org personnel were continually moved from one position to another on the chart, which meant that people were constantly being reassigned to different posts, whimsically, and no post was secure. About 900 positions needed to be filled at Int and Gold bases, and the stack of personnel and ethics files was 5 feet high. This anarchic process had been going on more or less intensively for 4 years. At odd, unpredictable hours, often in the middle of the night, Miscavige would show up in the Hole, accompanied by his wife, Shelley, and his communicator, Loris Stuckenbrock, each of whom carried a tape recorder to take down whatever Miscavige had to say. The detainees could hear the drumbeat of the shoes as Miscavige's entourage marched toward the trailers. The leader demanded that the executives engage in what were termed seances, endless hours of confessions about their crimes and failures in this and previous lives, as well as whatever dark thoughts, counter-intentions, they might be harboring against him. If someone was not forthcoming with such confessions, the group would harass that person until he produced a confession. Sometimes these were sexual fantasies. That would be written up in a report, which Miscavige would then read aloud to other church officials. The entire base became paralyzed with anxiety about being thrown into the Hole. People were trying desperately to police their thoughts, but it was difficult to keep secrets when staff members were constantly being security checked with e-meters. Even confidences whispered to a spouse were regularly betrayed. After one of COB's lengthy rants, recordings of his statement would be sent to a steno pool, then transcripts were delivered to the executives in the Hole, who had to read them aloud to each other repeatedly. Mike Rinder was in the Hole for 2 years, even though he continued to be the church's chief spokesperson. Bizarrely, he would sometimes be pulled out and ordered to conduct a press conference or to put on a tuxedo and jet off to a Scientology gala. Then he would be returned to confinement. He and other executives were made to race around the room on their hands and bare knees day after day, tearing open scabs on their knees and leaving permanent scars. Miscavige once directed DeVocht to rough up Rinder because he's just an SP. DeVocht took Rinder outside and gave him a going over, but DeVocht was also frightened of Miscavige. He took to sleeping with a broken broom handle. When another executive spoke up about the violence, he was beaten by two of Miscavige's assistants and made to mop the bathroom floor with his tongue. The detainees developed a particular expression whenever Miscavige came in, which he took note of. He called them pie faces. To illustrate what he meant, Miscavige drew a circle with two dots for eyes and a straight line for a mouth. He had T-shirts made up with the pie face on it. Rinder was the father of pie faces. People didn't know how to react. They didn't want to call attention to themselves, but they also didn't want to be a pie face. In Scientology, there is a phrase that explains mob psychology, contagion of aberration, meaning that groups of people can stimulate each other to do things that are insane. According to former church executives, one day Miscavige arrived at the hole and demanded that Mark Yeager, the commanding officer of the Commodore's Messengers Org, and Guillaume Lesevre, the executive director of the Church of Scientology International, confess that they were homosexual lovers. He threatened that Tom Cruise would come to punch you guys out if the other Sea Org members in the hole failed to get a confession from the two men. The captive executives took this threat seriously. When Miscavige left, a group of women executives who had been appointed as leaders of the detainees urged some of the bigger men in the hole to give some people some black eyes before Tom has to. Several men dutifully beat up Lesevre and Yeager. Then one of the women reported to Miscavige that the men had confessed that they were gay lovers. When Debbie Cook, the former captain of Flag Service Org and one of the most respected executives in the church, said that wasn't true, she was declared a traitor. She was made to stand in a garbage can for 12 hours as the other detainees demanded that she confess her own homosexual tendencies. The women in the room repeatedly slapped her and poured water over her head. A sign was hung around her neck saying, "Lesbo." Rathbun was seen as being COB's chief enforcer. During meetings in the hole or elsewhere on the base, he would stand to one side and glare at his colleagues while, he says, Miscavige berated and abused them. Although he was physically intimidating, Rathbun was suffering from a number of physical ailments, including a bad back, gallstones, calcium deposits in his neck, and painful varicose veins, which he believed came from having to stand at attention for hours on end. He, too, was prone to bursts of sudden violence. Once on a phone call, I saw him get so mad that he put his fist right through a computer screen, his former wife recalled. Miscavige would send him down to observe what was going on in the hole and come back with reports. In January 2004, when Rinder was accused of withholding a confession from the group, Rathbun took him outside and beat him up. Rathbun says Miscavige wasn't satisfied. He called Rathbun into his massive office in the Religious Technology Center, a cold and imposing room with steel walls and 18-foot ceilings, and accused him of letting Rinder get away with murder. Then, according to Rathbun, out of nowhere, Miscavige grabbed him by the throat and slammed his head against the steel wall. Footnote, as previously noted, the church denies all allegations of abuse by Miscavige. End footnote. Rathbun blacked out for a moment. He wasn't hurt, but the terms had changed. A few days later, Rathbun found himself in the hole, along with the entire international management team and other executives. Miscavige said they were going to stay there until they got the org board done. Scientologists are trained to believe that whatever happens to them is somehow their fault, so much of the discussion in the hole centered on what they had done to deserve this fate. The possibility that the leader of the church might be irrational or even insane was so taboo that no one could even think it, much less voice it aloud. Most of the people in the hole had a strong allegiance to the group, Scientology and the Sea Org, and they didn't want to let their comrades down. Many had been in the Sea Org their entire adult lives and portions of their childhood. Mike Rinder joined the Sea Org when he was 18. Amy Scobie was 16. Tom DeVocht was 13. They had already surrendered the possibility of ordinary family life. Sex outside of marriage was taboo, so many members married in their teens. But since 1986, children have been forbidden to Sea Org members. Former church executives say that abortions were common and forcefully encouraged. Claire Headley married Mark when she was 17. By the time she was 21, she had been pushed to have 2 abortions. She estimates that 60 to 80% of the women on Gold Base have had abortions. "It's a constant practice," she said. Footnote. The church denies that anyone in the Sea Org has ever been pressured to have an abortion. End footnote. Worried about pillow talk, Miscavige instituted a policy of imposed divorces in 2004. People in the Religious Technology Center, the Commodore's Messenger Organization, and Golden Era Productions could not be married to members in other divisions. For many of those people in the whole, everyone they knew or cared about was in the church. The cost of leaving, emotionally and spiritually, as well as financially, was forbidding. And they knew if they tried to run away, they'd likely be found and punished. Those who attempted to leave the Sea Org through the formal process of routing out would be presented with a freeloader tab for all the coursework and counseling they had received over the years. Claire and Mark Headley, for instance, were billed more than $150,000 when they left and told they would have to pay if they ever wanted to see their family again. Those who accept this offer can spend years paying off their debt. Those who don't stand to lose any connection to their friends and family who remain in Scientology. Many had long since turned their back on friends and family who were not in the church, and the prospect of facing them again brought up feelings of shame. The thought of leaving loved ones still in the church was even more fraught. All of these conflicting emotions were informed by the Scientology theory that life goes on, and that the mission of the church is to clear the planet. So in the scheme of things, the misery one might be suffering now is temporary and negligible. There is a larger goal. One is always working for the greatest good for the greatest number of dynamics, as Scientology ethics prescribed. And so the executives of the church who had given their lives to the Sea Org directed their confusion and their anger inward or toward their helpless colleagues. Rinder was an inevitable target. He was seen as being arrogant and above it all. Few people other than Rathbun really understood Rinder's job. Unlike the others, the two men were often off the base, dealing with lawyers, the government, and the press. No doubt there was resentment at work as well. The next time the Sea Org executives turned on Rinder, Rathbun exploded. He caught his friend in a headlock and slammed him to the ground, then sat astride him, pounding his head into the floor and shouting at him nose to nose. Rinder managed to whisper, "Marty, I don't want to play this game anymore." Suddenly, Rathbun froze. Words had been spoken that broke the spell, but it was only a moment. One evening, about 8 o'clock, Miscavige arrived with his wife and his communicator, Shelley and Loris, flanking him as usual with tape recorders in their hands. He ordered that the conference table be taken away and chairs be brought in for everyone in the hole, about 70 people at the time, including many of the most senior people in the Sea Org. He asked if anyone knew what musical chairs meant. In Scientology, it refers to frequent changes of post. About 500 people had been moved off their jobs in the last 5 years, creating anarchy in the management structure. But that wasn't the point he was trying to make. Finally, someone suggested that it was also a game. Miscavige had him explain the rules. Chairs are arranged in a circle, and then as the players march around them, one chair is removed. When the music stops, everybody grabs a seat. The one left standing is eliminated. Then the music starts again. Miscavige explained that in this game, the last person to grab a chair would be the only one allowed to stay on the base. Everyone else was to be offloaded, kicked out of the Sea Org, or sent away to the least desirable Scientology bases around the world. those whose spouses were not in the whole would be forced to divorce. While Queen's Greatest Hits played on a boombox, the church executives marched around and around, then fought for a seat when the music stopped. As the number of chairs diminished, the game got more physical. The executives shoved and punched each other. Clothes were torn. A chair was ripped apart. All this time, the biting lyrics of Bohemian Rhapsody floated over the saccharine melody. Is this the real life? Is this just a fantasy? Caught in a landslide, no escape from reality. Rathbun, with his bad back, was eliminated fairly quickly. Rinder, DeVocht, Mark Headley, one by one, they found themselves standing alone, behind low cubicle walls, watching the surviving contestants desperately fighting to remain in the hole rather than be sent off to God knows where. There was a clock over the door marking the hours that passed as the music played on and on, then suddenly stopped, and the riot began again. As people fell out of the game, COB had airline tickets for distant locations printed up for them at the base's travel office. There were U-Haul trucks waiting outside to haul away their belongings. Is it real to you now? Miscavige teased. They were told that buses would be ready to leave at 6 a.m. Many were in tears. I don't see anybody weeping for me, Miscavige said. The utter powerlessness of everyone else in the room was made nakedly clear to them. The game continued until 4 a.m., when a woman named Lisa Schroer grabbed the final chair. The next morning, the whole event was forgotten. No one went anywhere. In several legal declarations he has made over the years, Miscavige has protested, I am the ecclesiastical leader of the religion, not the church. The distinction is important when the church is dragged into lawsuits or threatened with criminal liability. Miscavige can point to a chart that assigns organizational responsibility to other departments, whereas the sole responsibility of the Religious Technology Center, which he heads, is to protect Scientology doctrine and literature. And yet Miscavige freely consigned those other department heads to the hole, or sent them to RPF. During the period that the organizational chart was being constantly rearranged, the only reliable posting on the base was his, that of COBRTC. Everyone else was constantly being uprooted and repotted in other temporary assignments. There is really only one person in charge of the Church of Scientology. A few days after the musical chairs episode, Miscavige ordered everyone in the hole to report to Golden Era Productions to stuff CDs into cases. At one point, he began sharply interrogating DeVocht, who was shaken and stuttered in response. According to DeVocht, Miscavige punched him in the face. He felt his head vibrate. He tried to turn away from the next blow, but Miscavige grabbed his neck and shoved him into the floor, pummeling and kicking him. Footnote, the church denies that Miscavige has ever abused members of the church. End footnote. DeVocht had served Miscavige for years and had even considered him a friend. He had dedicated his life to Scientology and had been in the Sea Org for nearly 30 years. He recalls thinking, now here I am being beat up by the top dog in front of my peers. After the attack, Miscavige continued his speech. DeVocht was so humiliated that he couldn't bring himself to look at his companions. Finally, he managed to glance at them. Pie faces. Rathbun was there, and at that moment, he made a decision. As the other executives were being led back to the hole, he slipped away and got his motorcycle and hid in the bushes. When a car finally approached, he raced through the open gate into the outside world. Chapter 9 TC and COB. Great fame also imposes a kind of cloister on those who join its ranks. Tom Cruise had been a movie star since he was 21, with two popular movies in the same year, The Outsiders and Risky Business. By age 25, he was the biggest star in Hollywood, on his way to becoming one of the most famous movie legends in history. At the same age, Miscavige had become the de facto leader of Scientology. Each of these men assumed extraordinary responsibilities when their peers were barely beginning their careers. Their youth and position set them apart, so it was natural that two such powerful, isolated men would see themselves mirrored in each other. A number of Sea Org members who observed Cruise when he came to Gold Base remarked that he seemed liberated to be in an environment where no one hassled him or took his photograph or asked for autographs. There are cottages built for the use of other well-known Scientologists, such as John Travolta, Kirstie Alley, Edgar Winter, and Priscilla Presley, so the base can sometimes feel like a secret celebrity spa. Once, Miscavige had the entire Gold Base crew line up at the gate and salute Cruise when he arrived. Cruise must have felt self-conscious about this display because it happened only once. People on the base have been directed not to speak to Cruise at all unless spoken to. In this way, Cruise tastes the life that Miscavige has lived for decades, one of seclusion and deference, concentrated on spiritual advancement. Footnote. Cruise's attorney says that Sea Org members were not directed to salute him and that he has had many cordial exchanges with them. End footnote. Similarly, after becoming associated with Cruise, the style of Miscavige's life began to reflect that of a fantastically wealthy and leisured movie star. He normally awakens at noon with a cup of coffee and a Camel cigarette. The coffee is fresh ground Starbucks, preferably a Guatemala or Arabian mocha java, made with distilled water to which he adds raw sugar and half and half. Then he takes breakfast, the first of his five meals. According to Miscavige's former chef, Sinar Parman, the church leader was eating three squares and a snack at night, until the late 90s. One day, while on a Delta flight from L.A. to Clearwater, Miscavige walked to the cabin from his seat in first class and showed some photos from a muscle magazine to Parman and his steward, who traveled with him. He told them he wanted to get ripped and have six-pack abs. After the flight, Miscavige changed physical trainers and began taking bodybuilding supplements. He also adopted a strict diet that requires each meal to be at least 40% protein and to contain no more than 400 calories. Soon he was looking like the men in the muscle magazines. To maintain his physique, Miscavige's chefs have to enter each portion size into a computer, including the cream in his morning coffee. Miscavige often starts with an omelet of one whole egg and five egg whites. 2.5 hours later, lunch is provided. Two choices would be prepared daily for both him and his wife, four meals altogether. Miscavige prefers pizza, soup, and submarine sandwiches. Throughout the day, cigarettes, bottled water, and protein bars are stationed wherever he might be working. Dinner is a five-course meal, and once again, dual entrees are prepared for him to choose from. Miscavige's favorite foods include wild mushroom risotto, linguine in white clam sauce, and pâté de foie gras. Fresh fruit and vegetables are purchased from local markets or shipped in from overseas. Several times a week, a truck from Santa Monica Seafood brings Atlantic salmon or live lobster, flown in fresh from the East Coast or Canada. Corn-fed lamb arrives from New Zealand. When guests such as Tom Cruise come to dinner, the kitchen goes into extravagant bursts of invention, with ingredients sometimes flown in from different continents. 2 hours after dinner, the first evening snack arrives, with lighter offerings such as Italian white bean soup or clam chowder. After midnight, there is a final late-night snack, a selection of non-fat cheeses, an apple crisp or blueberry crepes, often garnished with edible flowers. Shelley usually preferred a fruit platter. She would drink only almond milk, which was made on-site from organic almonds. She insisted that all the food be consistent with the diet recommended for their blood type. Both Shelley and David are type O. Two full-time chefs work all day preparing these meals with several full-time stewards to serve them. According to Claire Headley, who oversaw the finances for the Religious Technology Center between 2000 and 2004, the food costs for David and Shelley and their guests would range between $3,000 to as much as $20,000 per week. At the end of the evening, Miscavige retires to his den and drinks Macallan Scotch and plays backgammon with members of his entourage or listens to music on his $150,000 stereo system. He loves Michael Jackson, or watches movies in his private screening room. His favorite films are Scarface and the Godfather trilogy. He usually turns in around 3 or 4 in the morning. Miscavige enjoys shooting pool or playing video games in his lounge. He has a tanning bed and a high-end gym that few people other than Cruz are permitted to use. Although he is short in stature, Miscavige exudes physical power. He favors tight-fitting T-shirts that show off his chiseled biceps. He collects guns, maintains at least 6 motorcycles, and has a number of automobiles, including an armor-plated GMC Safari van with bulletproof windows and satellite television, and a souped-up Saline Mustang that Cruz gave him to match his own. His uniforms and business suits are fashioned by Richard Lim, a Los Angeles tailor whose clients include Cruz, Will Smith, and Martin Sheen. Miscavige's shoes are custom-made in London by John Lobb, bootmaker to the royal family. His wardrobe fills an entire room. 2 full-time stewards are responsible for his cleaning and laundry. Cruz admired the house cleaning so much, even Miscavige's light bulbs are polished once a month, that the church leader sent a Sea Org team to Cruz's Telluride retreat to train the Star's staff. Until 2007, when he traveled, Miscavige would often rent Cruz's Gulfstream jet, but he has since upgraded to a roomier Boeing business jet at a cost of $30,000 to $50,000 per trip. He brings along his personal hairdresser and chiropractor. He loves underwater photography, and when he returns from his annual trip on the Free Winds, he has the photography staff put the photos into slides so they can be appreciated by the entire Gold Base staff. The contrast with the other Sea Org members is stark. They eat in a mess hall, which features a meat and potatoes diet and a salad bar, except for occasional extended periods of rice and beans for those who are being punished. The average cost per meal as of 2005, according to Mark Headley, who participated in the financial planning each week, was about 75 cents a head, significantly less than what is spent per inmate in the California prison system. When members join the Sea Org, they are issued 2 sets of pants, 2 shirts, and a pair of shoes, which is their lifetime clothing allotment. Anything else, they purchase themselves. Although the nominal pay for Sea Org members is $50 a week, many are fined for various infractions, so it's not unusual to be paid as little as $13 or $14. Married couples at Gold Base share a 2-bedroom apartment with 2 other couples, meaning that one pair sleeps on the couch. In any case, few get more than 5 or 6 hours of sleep a night. There are lavish exercise facilities at the base, an Olympic pool, a golf course, basketball courts, but they are rarely used. Few are permitted to have access to computers. Every personal phone call is listened to. Every letter is inspected. Bank records are opened and records kept of how much money people have. Cultural touchstones common to most Americans are often lost on Sea Org members at Goldbase. They may not know the name of the President of the United States or be able to tell the difference between the Republican and Democratic parties. It's not as if there is no access to outside information. There is a big screen television in the dining hall, and people can listen to the radio or subscribe to newspapers and magazines. However, news from the outside world begins to lose its relevance when people are outside of the wider society for extended periods of time. Many Sea Org members have not left the base for a decade. On April 30th of each year, Scientology staff from around the world are pressed to contribute to Miscavige's birthday present. One year, as birthday assessments were being passed around, few could contribute because they hadn't been paid for months. Finally, staffers got their back pay so that they could make their donations. Janella Webster, who worked directly under Miscavige for 15 years, received $325, out of which she paid $150 for Miscavige's gift. Such presents include tailored suits and leather jackets, high-end cameras, diving equipment, Italian shoes, and a handmade titanium bicycle. One year, Flag Service Org in Clearwater gave him a Virus 985 C3 4V, a motorcycle with a retail price of $70,000. Footnote: according to Tommy Davis, from their perspective, it was the least they could do to express their affection. End footnote. Another division presented him with a BMW. Miscavige keeps a number of dogs, including 5 beagles. He had blue vests made up for each of them, with 4 stripes on the shoulder epaulettes indicating the rank of Sea Org captain. He insists that people salute the dogs as they parade by. The dogs have a mini treadmill where they work out. A full-time staff member feeds, walks, and trains the dogs, takes them to the veterinarian, and enters one of them, Jelly, into contests where he has attained championship status. Another of Miscavige's favorites, a Dalmatian pit bull mix named Buster, went on a rampage one day and killed 10 peacocks on the property, then proudly laid them out for all to see. Buster has also attacked various members of the staff, sending one elderly woman to the emergency room and earning Buster his own ethics folder. Miscavige eventually had the dog taken away to another Sea Org base, even though he believed that Buster had a nose for out-ethics behavior. The relieved staff members joked that Buster had been sent to dog RPF. From an early age, Miscavige had taken control of his family. His father, Ron Sr., joined the Sea Org following a charge of attempted rape lodged against him in 1985. Former church members say that significant church resources were used to contain the scandal, and that David forced his father to join the Sea Org. Because David's mother, Loretta, refused to sign up for that, she and Ron agreed to divorce. She continued in Scientology, rising to the summit as an OT-8. She worked as an accountant for the law firm of Greta Van Susteren, the television commentator, and her husband, John Cole, both Scientologists, who maintain a mansion on Clearwater Beach. Loretta was a heavy smoker who suffered from emphysema and obesity, scarcely the image of an operating thetan, but her self-deprecating, sometimes goofy sense of humor made her popular among the staff and upper-level Scientologists, the court jester of the Scientology Country Club, as Rathbun called her. Loretta's regal position as the leader's mother allowed her to give rein to gossipy stories about Dave's childhood, which she told in a thick Philly accent. Miscavige complained that his mother was trying to destroy him. He ordered Rathbun to run a security check on her using the e-meter. When Loretta realized what he was up to, she burst out laughing. Miscavige sent his personal trainer to help his mother get in shape, and he had church members monitoring her diet, but her chronic health problems overtook her. She was sick for a long time, her granddaughter, Jenna Miscavige Hill, recalled. She was not happy with the turn the church took. Sometimes Loretta would burst into tears. I would try to help her the only way I knew how, Hill said. She was an amazing grandma. Loretta Miscavige died in 2005. The level of abuse at the Gold Base was increasing year by year as, unpoliced by outside forces, other senior executives began emulating their leader. Rinder, DeVocht, and Rathbun all admit to striking other staff members. Even some of the women became physically aggressive, slapping underlings when they didn't perform up to standard. Debbie Cook, the former leader of Flag Base, says that although Miscavige never struck her, he ordered his communicator to do so. Another time, she said, he told his communicator to break Cook's finger. She bent Cook's finger, but failed to actually break it. Miscavige can be charming and kind, especially to Sea Org members who need emotional or medical assistance. He has a glittering smile and a commanding voice. And yet former Scientologists who were close to him recall that his constant profanity and bursts of unprovoked violence kept everyone off balance. Jefferson Hawkins, a former Sea Org executive who had worked with Paul Haggis on the rejected Dianetics campaign, says he was beaten by Miscavige on 5 occasions, the first time in 2002. He had just written an infomercial for the church. Miscavige summoned him to a meeting where about 40 members were seated on one side of a long conference table. Miscavige routinely sits by himself on the other side. He began a tirade about the shortcomings of the infomercial. When Hawkins started to respond, Miscavige cut him short. The only thing I want to hear from you is your crimes, Miscavige said, meaning that Hawkins was to confess his subversive intentions. Then, without warning, Miscavige jumped on the table and launched himself at Hawkins, knocking him against a cubicle wall and battering him in the face. The two men fell to the floor and their legs became entangled. Let go of my legs, Miscavige shouted. Miscavige extricated himself and left the room, leaving Hawkins on the floor, shocked, bruised, disheveled, humiliated, and staring at the 40 people who did nothing to support him. Get up, they told him. Don't make him wrong. Even if he had had access to a phone, Hawkins wouldn't have called the police. If a Sea Org member were to seek outside help, he would be punished either by being declared a suppressive person or by being sent off to do manual labor for months or years. Far more important, Hawkins believed, was the fact that his spiritual immortality was on the line. Scientology had made him aware of his eternal nature as he moved from life to life, erasing his fear of mortality. Without that, he would be doomed to dying over and over again, in ignorance and darkness, he said, never knowing my true nature as a spirit. Miscavige, he concluded, holds the power of eternal life and death over you. The church provided an affidavit of a former Sea Org member, Yael Lustgarten, who stated that she was present at the meeting and that the attack by Miscavige never happened. She claims that Hawkins made a mess of his presentation. He smelled of body odor, he was unshaven, his voice tone was very low, and he could hardly be heard. And he was merely instructed to shape up. On the other hand, Amy Scobie said she witnessed the attack. It was her cubicle the two men fell into. And after the altercation, she recalled, "I gathered all the buttons from Jeff's shirt and the change from his pockets and gave them back to him." Tommy Davis later testified that he had conducted an investigation of the charges of abuse at the base. he said that all of the abuse had been committed by Rinder, Rathbun, and DeVocht, none by Miscavige. Tom DeVocht grew up in a little central Florida town called Fort Meade. When he was 10 years old in 1974, his cousin, Dickie Thompson, a keyboardist in the Steve Miller Band, came to visit riding a Harley-Davidson motorcycle. That year, the band had a number one song, The Joker, and Thompson rode into town with a glow of fame around him. He had a weird stare, DeVocht remembered. He invited my sister to meet Steve Miller and John Travolta. Within a year, most of DeVocht's family had joined the Church of Scientology. In July 1977, 13-year-old Tom DeVocht signed the billion-year contract for the Sea Org. DeVocht became one of Miscavige's allies and moved up the bureaucratic ladder quickly. In 1986, he was appointed the commanding officer of the Commodore's Messengers Org at FLAG. In 2001, Miscavige called him, complaining, "Tom, I can't get my building done." The new headquarters for the Religious Technology Center at Gold Base, Building 50, was years behind schedule and well over budget. Miscavige directed DeVocht to come to Gold Base and oversee the construction. The first day he got there, DeVocht realized that this building is going to be the end of me. $47 million, more than $1,000 per square foot, had previously been spent on the new center. The building had already been completed a couple of times using the highest-grade materials, cold-rolled steel and anagray, a beautiful but extremely hard, pinkish African wood, only to have components ripped out because they didn't meet Miscavige's standards. Miscavige's desk, also made of steel, was so heavy that DeVocht worried whether the structure would support it. He discovered that there were no actual architectural drawings for the building. There were only renderings of what it should look like. The stucco exterior walls were already cracked because the whole edifice was at a 1.25-inch tilt. The walls weren't actually connected to the floors. Even a minor earthquake, Gold Base was just west of the San Andreas Fault, might cause the whole building to collapse. DeVocht recommended that the building be torn down and rebuilt from scratch, but Miscavige rejected that idea. The expense of essentially rebuilding a poorly constructed building from the inside was immense. When DeVocht had almost finished construction, having spent an additional $60 million, Miscavige still had a list of complaints. He was also critical of the landscaping. Gold Base is in a desert, but Miscavige demanded that the building appear to be set in a forest. One morning, DeVocht says, Miscavige and his wife were inspecting the large vault in the legal department of Building 50 when the leader stopped in his tracks and began rubbing his head. He turned pale. "Where did we put the gold bullion?" he asked his wife. For a full minute, Miscavige kept rubbing his head and asking about the gold, but then he snapped out of it and went on as if nothing had happened. DeVocht recalls that 45 minutes later, Shelley Miscavige called him and asked him, "What are we going to do? He's losing it." She told him that Dave had gone type 3, psychotic, because of all the suppressive persons at the base. Footnote: according to Tommy Davis, these incidents are pure fantasy by Tom DeVocht. End footnote. While DeVocht was working on Building 50, he was forced to attend a seance with 500 other Sea Org members on Gold Base. People were called out by name and asked, "What crimes have you committed against David Miscavige?" One after another, people approached the microphone and confessed to ways in which they were suppressing the dissemination of Scientology or thinking taboo thoughts. DeVocht was disgusted by the orgy of self-abasement. One night, he simply took over the meeting and brought some semblance of order to it. That night, Shelley Miscavige asked him to be the commanding officer of the Commodore's Messengers Org, which essentially put him in charge of the entire base. "It's out of control," she pleaded, saying that her husband counted on him and had no one else to turn to. In 2004, De Vogt finished reconstructing the 45,000-square-foot Building 50, which wound up costing $70 million. "You're the biggest spender in the history of Scientology," Miscavige told him. "You should be shot." Even though membership in the church has been declining for years, according to polls and census figures, money continues to pour into Scientology coffers in fantastic sums. Donors are accorded higher status depending on the size of their gifts to the International Association of Scientologists. Patron Maximus for a $25 million pledge, for instance. Nancy Cartwright, the voice of Bart Simpson, became a patron laureate for her $10 million gift to the association in 2007. The IAS now holds more than $1 billion, mostly in offshore accounts, according to former executives of the church. Scientology coursework alone can be very pricey, as much as $400,000 to reach the level of OT8. That doesn't count the books and materials or the latest model E-meter, which is priced at $4,650. Then there is the auditing, which ranges in price from $5,000 to $8,000 for a 12-hour intensive, depending on the location and the level of the auditor. Services sold in Clearwater alone amount to $100 million a year. Despite the frequent cost overruns on construction, Scientology undertook a worldwide building campaign, kicked off by Miscavige's decision to use the occasion of 9/11 to issue a call for a massive expansion of the church. "Bluntly, we are the only people of Earth who can reverse the decline," he announced. "The way to do better is to get big." In some cases, the building projects have become significant moneymakers for the church. Across the street from Scientology's Fort Harrison Hotel in Clearwater is the Superpower Building, intended to be a training facility to enhance the perceptions of upper-level Thetans. The fundraising kicked off with a $1 million gift from the Feshbach brothers. Despite years-long construction delays and fines imposed by the city of Clearwater, the 380,000-square-foot Superpower Building has proven to be a bonanza for the church, which has taken in at least $145 million in donations to complete the project, $120 million more than it was projected to cost when first proposed in 1993. The church explains that the plan has been enlarged from its original goals, which has created delays and additional expenses. Tom DeVogt, who worked on the construction for years, said that the building remained unfinished for so long because no one knew what superpower was. Under Miscavige's leadership, the church has aggressively launched a program called Ideal Orgs, which aim to replicate the grandeur of Hubbard's St. Hill Manor. A number of the Ideal Orgs have been shuttered, including Seattle, Boston, and New Haven, because the local Scientology communities were unable to support them. Other notable churches and missions are now boarded up or unloaded, including one in Santa Monica that Paul and Deborah Haggis raised money to establish. The intensity of the pressure on Sea Org members to raise money for the church while working for next to nothing can be understood in part through the account of Daniel Montalvo. His parents joined the Sea Org when he was 5, and the very next year he signed his own billion-year contract. He says that he began working full-time in the organization when he was 11, and recalls that, along with other Sea Org members, including children, his days stretched from 8 in the morning until 11:30 at night. Part of his work was shoveling up asbestos that had been removed during the renovation of the Fort Harrison Hotel. He says no protective gear was provided, not even a mask. He rarely saw his parents. While he was at Flag Base in 2005, when he was 14, he guarded the door while Tom Cruise was in session. The sight of children working at a Sea Org facility would not have been unusual. They were separated from their parents and out of school. According to Florida child labor laws, minors who are 14 and 15 years old are prohibited from working during school hours and may work only up to 15 hours a week. Daniel said that he was allowed schooling only one day a week, on Saturday. When Daniel was 15, he was assigned to work on the renovation of Scientology's publications building in Los Angeles, operating scissors lifts and other heavy equipment. According to California child labor laws, 15-year-old children are allowed to work only 3 hours per day outside of school, except on weekends, no more than 18 hours per week total. 16 is the minimum age for children to work in any manufacturing establishment using power-driven hoisting apparatus, such as the scissors lift. Daniel graduated to work at the church's auditing complex nearby, called the American St. Hill Organization. Then, from 6 in the evening until 3 in the morning, he volunteered at Bridge Publications. He was paid $36 a week. Daniel's work at Bridge Publications was sufficiently impressive that he was posted full-time in the manufacturing division there the following year. The church had issued a new edition of Hubbard's books and lectures called The Basics, which was being aggressively marketed to Scientologists. One of Daniel's jobs was to cut the thumb notches that mark the glossary and the appendix in these handsomely made books, like the notches one would find in an unabridged dictionary. A machine with a guillotine steel blade slices through the pages to produce the half-moon indentation. California law specifically forbids the operation of the machine by anyone under the age of 18. Daniel noted about 20 other miners working at the plant, all of them sleep-deprived and working around heavy equipment. One night, Daniel chopped off his right index finger on the notching machine. A security officer picked up his finger and put it in a plastic bag with ice, then took Daniel to the Children's Hospital in Hollywood. He was instructed to tell the admitting nurse that he had injured himself in a skateboarding accident. The doctors were unable to reattach his finger. After that, Daniel was sent to the sales division of Bridge Publications. Sales had been declining since The Basics had been first published in 2007. The Basics included 18 books and a number of Hubbard lectures on CD. The complete package cost $6,500. Sea Orgs all over the world had call centers set up to sell them. In Los Angeles, there were hourly quotas to be met, and those who failed suffered various punishments, such as having water dumped on their head or being made to do push-ups or run up and down the stairs. There were security guards on every floor. A salesperson had to get a slip verifying that he had made his quota before he was permitted to go to bed. Often it was simply impossible to make the quota legitimately, so people ran unauthorized credit cards. Members of the Sea Org sales force would break into the church's financial records and pull up the credit card information of public members. Members who had money on account at the church for future courses would see it drained to pay for books they didn't order. Parishioners who balked at making contributions or buying unwanted materials were told they were in violation of church ethics, and their progress in Scientology was blocked or threatened. Members who pledge more than they can afford can find themselves in a compromised situation. One Scientologist who was a bank teller says he was told to comply with a robbery in order to pay off his debt to the church. The robbers took $4,000. In 2009, Nancy Cartwright's fiancé, Stephen E. Brackett, a contractor, had taken a substantial construction advance to renovate a restaurant. The company that insured the project later sued Cartwright, claiming that she and Brackett had diverted the money to the Church of Scientology. Brackett, an OT5, had been featured in a church ad for the Superpower Building, identified as a key contributor. "Mankind needs your help," Brackett was quoted as saying in the ad. He later took his life by jumping off a bridge on Pacific Coast Highway near Big Sur. Footnote: the case against Cartwright was settled out of court. End footnote. The biggest financial scandal involving church members was a Ponzi scheme operated by Reed Slatkin. He was one of the co-founders with Paul Haggis's friend Sky Dayton of Earthlink. Slatkin's massive fraud involved more than $500 million in investments. Much of the initial profit was returned to Scientology investors such as Daniel and Myrna Jacobs, who earned nearly $3 million on a $760,500 investment. According to Marty Rathbun, Slatkin's Scientology investors included Ann Archer and Fox News commentator Greta Van Susteren. Later investors were not so lucky. Slatkin was convicted of defrauding $240 million. It is still not known how much of that money went directly to the church, although the court found that about $50 million was funneled to the church indirectly by investors with massive gains. In 2006, groups affiliated with the Church of Scientology, including the Celebrity Center, agreed to pay back $3.5 million. In July 2004, Miscavige hosted Tom Cruise's 42nd birthday party aboard the Scientology cruise ship Free Winds. The Golden Era musicians, including Miscavige's father on trumpet, played songs from Cruise's movies as film clips flickered on the giant overhead screens installed especially for the occasion. Cruise himself danced and sang old-time rock and roll, reprising a famous scene in Risky Business, the movie that firmly established him as a star. Occasionally, the Free Winds is used to confine those Sea Org members that the church considers most at risk for flight. Among the crew on the ship during Cruise's birthday party was Valeska Paris, a 26-year-old Swiss woman. Paris had grown up in Scientology and joined the Sea Org when she was 14. 3 years later, her stepfather, a self-made millionaire, committed suicide, leaving a diary in which he blamed the church for fleecing his fortune. When Valeska's mother denounced the church on French television, Valeska was isolated at the Clearwater base in order to keep her away from her mother. The next year, at the age of 18, she was sent to the Free Winds. She was told she would be on the ship for 2 weeks. She was held there against her will for 12 years. Shortly before Cruise arrived, Paris developed a cold sore, which caused Miscavige to consign her to a condition of treason. So she wasn't allowed to go to the birthday party, but she later did wind up serving Cruise and his girlfriend at the time, the Spanish actress Penelope Cruz. In October, Miscavige acknowledged Cruise's place in Scientology by awarding him the Freedom Medal of Valor. Miscavige called Cruise the most dedicated Scientologist I know before an audience of Sea Org members who had spent much of their lives working for the church for a little more than $7 a day. Then he hung the diamond-encrusted platinum medallion around the star's neck. "I think you know that I am there for you," Cruise said to the thrilled audience, "and I do care so very, very, very much." He turned to an imposing portrait of Hubbard standing beside a globe. "To LRH," he said with a crisp salute. Lana Mitchell, the cook who had been accused of feeding Cruise the poisoned shrimp a few months before, had gotten out of Happy Valley, but she watched the ceremony while in RPF along with some 200 of her detained colleagues. About 50 of them were Sea Org executives who had been purged by Miscavige. They were being held in the Los Angeles complex on L. Ron Hubbard Way, in the massive blue former hospital where Spanky Taylor and so many others had been confined. Some had been in the organization for more than 20 years and had worked directly for Hubbard. They were completely cut off from the outside world, no television, radio, or even any music. As many as 40 people were crammed into each of the former hospital rooms with only one bathroom to share. Often there was not enough food to go around. Some of those confined had severe medical conditions, including Uwe Stuckenbrock, the former international security chief who suffered from multiple sclerosis and had deteriorated to the point of being unable to speak. One of the jobs Mitchell was assigned on RPF was welding, but she had never done it before, and she burned her eyes because she wasn't wearing the protective glasses correctly. She got no medical attention at all. Every effort was made to keep RPFers out of view. Windows were curtained so no one could see in or out. They traveled through tunnels and over rooftops when they needed to move about within the complex. There were no days off, although they were allowed to call their families on Christmas. Their sole diversion was watching the big Scientology galas on television. After all, the elaborate sets for these events were constructed by the RPFers in Los Angeles or at Flag Base in Clearwater. To view the big cruise event, they were all taken to the mess hall. One of the penitents was Mark McKinstry, who had been national sales manager at Bridge Publications when the movie version of Battlefield Earth, starring John Travolta, came out in 2000. Hubbard's tale is about an alien race of cyclos who have turned people into slaves until a hero arises to liberate humanity. Travolta had worked for years to get the movie made and wound up paying a significant portion out of his own pocket. It was at the peak of his career. "I told my manager, if we can't do the things now that we want to do, what good is the power?" he remarked at the time. Miscavige had been deeply involved in the filming from the beginning. He would watch dailies of the film in Clearwater while he was overseeing the handling of the Lisa McPherson case. His critiques would then be typed up and sent to the Scientology representative who was always at Travolta's side. When the movie was completed, Miscavige called Travolta to congratulate him, saying that LRH would be proud. He predicted it was going to be a blockbuster. McKinstry had been working for a year promoting the movie edition of the book. He traveled across the country with Travolta to push the book in bookstores, malls, and Walmarts. About 750,000 copies were sold. Like many others who have spent time with Travolta, McKinstry came to like him immensely. The actor was devoting a substantial amount of his own time and energy to making the book a success. But when the movie came out, it was a critical and box office catastrophe. Even at the premiere, Sea Org members had to be bussed in to Mann's Chinese Theater on Hollywood Boulevard to fill the empty seats for as many as three shows a day. For some of them, it was the first movie they had seen in years. "Battlefield Earth may well turn out to be the worst movie of this century," the New York Times critic observed in what proved to be a typical review. There were false accusations that the film contained subliminal messages promoting Scientology. Travolta's career went into a lengthy, dark period. Cruz later complained to Miscavige, saying that the movie was terrible for the church's public image. Footnote: Cruz's attorney notes, "Mr. Cruz has never expressed anything but support and respect for the work on Battlefield Earth." End footnote. Miscavige responded that it would never have been made if he'd had anything to do with it. McKinstry was dismayed when he went to a screening of the movie and watched people walking out or booing. His wife could see that he was upset and asked what was wrong. "Why didn't anyone watch this movie before it was released?" he said. She reported to the church what he had said, and he was ordered to RPF. Shortly before he received Scientology's top award, Cruz ended his 3-year relationship with Penelope Cruz. Shelley Miscavige had been supervising her auditing and helping her through the purification rundown. But like Nicole, Penelope was suspect in the eyes of the church's leader. She was an independent-minded person and continued to meditate and identify herself as a Buddhist. Cruz traveled with a Scientology delegation to open a magnificent new church in Madrid, where he read his speech to the crowd in halting Spanish. Before the opening, however, he was sitting with his sister Leanne, who had become his publicist. Mike Rinder, who was in the room, remembers that Cruz heatedly complained to his sister that no one had been able to find him a new girlfriend. Miscavige walked in, Rinder says, and Cruz made the same complaint to him. Footnote: Cruz's attorney says Cruz did not complain about not having a girlfriend at the opening of the church in Madrid. End footnote. Miscavige took the hint. "I want you to look for the prettiest women in the church," Tom DeVoogd remembers Miscavige saying. "Get their names and phone numbers." Miscavige then assigned Greg Wilhere and Tommy Davis to audition all the young actresses who were in Scientology, about 100, according to Mark Headley, who observed some of the videos. Shelley Miscavige, the leader's wife, oversaw the project personally. Wilhere and Davis immediately went to work. The women weren't told why they were being interviewed, but they were asked about their opinions of Cruz and where they were on the bridge. Wilhere, who was actually in the hole at the time, was taken out of confinement, given a BlackBerry and $5,000 to buy civilian clothes at a Saks Fifth Avenue outlet, then sent to New York and Los Angeles to videotape the interviews. Rinder noticed that when Cruz arrived at the Freedom Medal of Valor ceremony a month later, he was accompanied by a raven-haired young actress and model, Yolanda Pecoraro. She was born into Scientology and had completed a number of courses at the Celebrity Center and on the Free Winds, but she was only 19 years old. Cruz was 42 at the time. The Scientology search team came up with another aspiring actress, Nazanin Boniadi, 25 years old, who had been born in Iran and raised in London. Naz was well-educated and beautiful in the way that Cruz was inclined to respond to, dark and slender, with large eyes and a flashing smile. She had studied pre-med at the University of California at Irvine before deciding to try her luck as an actress. More important for the purposes of the match, however, was the fact that Boniadi was an OT5. Her mother was also a Scientologist. In early November 2004, Naz was informed that she had been selected for a special program that was critical to the future of the church, but it was so secret she wouldn't be allowed to tell anyone, even her mother. Naz was moved immediately into the Celebrity Center, where she spent a month going through security checks and special auditing programs. She hoped the project had something to do with human rights, which was her special interest, but all she was told was that her participation would end bigotry against Scientology. At one point during the intensive auditing and security checks, Wilhere informed her that she would have to break up with her longtime boyfriend in order for the project to proceed. She refused. She couldn't understand why her boyfriend posed any kind of problem. Indeed, she had personally introduced him to Scientology. Wilhere persisted, asking what it would take for her to break off the romance. Flustered, she responded that she would break up if she knew he had been cheating on her. According to Naz's friends, the very next day, Wilhere brought in her boyfriend's confidential auditing files and showed her several instances of his infidelities which had been circled in red. Naz felt betrayed, but also guilty, because Wilhere blamed her for failing to know and report her boyfriend's ethical lapses herself. After all, she had audited him on several occasions. Obviously, she had missed his withhold. She confronted her boyfriend, and he confessed. That was the end of their relationship. Footnote. The Church has stated, Scientology ministers maintain and practice a code of conduct known as the Auditor's Code. The Auditor's Code provides standards to ensure that priest-penitent communications remain strictly confidential. All such information is kept strictly confidential by a Scientology minister and the Church. End footnote.